everybody. You're listening to a very special satellite episode of the Comic Book Bears podcast. I'm Bill Zanowitz, one of the regular co-hosts of the CB Bears podcast. And late last year, we started doing a few satellite episodes of the Comic Book Bears podcast. Again, pushing that name there, where we would be talking about specific subjects, gave us an opportunity to take a deeper dive into something, usually on an archive basis, away from the regular show. And last year, we started with the Bears in the Toy Box with Chris Cummins. And tonight, I have a very special guest with me, and we're going to talk about our respective first years of collecting and reading comics. My guest is Mr. Michael Myers, Mike Myers of the Geek Brunch, the Valiant podcast, and also my favorite of the three, the DC Noise podcast. And along with Steve Raker, he is one of the coolest voices in comic book podcasting. And when we were talking about this on Facebook commentary that went back and forth, it seems that Mike and I have some very common starting points in relation to when we got interested in comic books. And this is something that I'm going to be developing as part of another project that I'll let everybody who is listening know about soon, contributing to a bigger project. And this is kind of helping me sort of formulate how I'm going to attack that. So, Mike, thank you very much for coming on. I'm really excited about talking about this with you.
Well, I'm glad. You saw a post on my Facebook about what I'm trying to do, and you're like, that sounds like me.
Yeah.
And we've already been friends for a while. You know, we met in Baltimore. Is that where we met?
Yeah, Baltimore.
Both 2 years in a row, I believe. Maybe three.
I think
man,
three.
It's been a while.
Yeah,
it's been quite a while. And we always have a passion, especially for like DC Comics, mm-hmm. Old DC. You know, we're always at the convention. We're running into each other quite a bit, looking at each other's stash of what we're picking up. And it just so happens that like 1973, I think, holds a very special place in my heart, and it sounds like in your heart too, because my world was kind of opened up to superheroes, which they were maybe in the terms of maybe toys and stuff, but I didn't know better at the time. But when Super Friends finally came out, it opened my life to a different world.
Yeah, it's kind of funny there. I think with some people, they don't have a specific date that they can pinpoint where something started. But for me, and for you, I guess, if you were there from the premiere, would have been September 8th, 1973. And I've said this on my own podcast in the past, and it's not hyperbole. I was one person at the beginning of that hour and another person when the show was over. It instilled an interest in me, which hasn't left. There have been times where I've abandoned it, but it was, even when I abandoned it, it was kind of simmering under the surface. I've always had an interest in superhero comic books in one level or one form or another since that time. And it changed me. It really did. I was a fan of something that it was instantaneous, really. And I had had some exposure to superheroes in the past from television. In the New York market, they had aired the Batman and Aquaman Filmation cartoons during the mornings, and they also had the Batman 66 show in the afternoon. So I had some exposure to them, but nothing that really, you know, really was like a lightning strike. So Mike, for you, was Super Friends also your first exposure?
Yeah, it was the lightning strike that sparked the compulsion, and many, many, many dollars later. I've never left. Comics have always been part of my life. I've reduced comics in times of financial need.
Right.
But I've always picked up a level of comics, especially like Flash, because Flash was my guy. And he wasn't really in the first incarnation of the Super Friends, but he did start to appear when they started having like the one guest shots, you know,
right.
Like they'd have the Atom or the Flash. And when Challenge of the Super Friends came, it just blew me away. Mm-hmm. But I've always catered towards the non-popular superheroes for some reason. And even in the Super Friends, I absolutely loved Aquaman.
Right.
Like, I loved Aquaman. I had a one of those bendable figures. You know those bend. I don't know what they're called. They're...
Oh, the Mego Bend and Flex.
Yeah, the Bend and Flex. They had a wire in them, and I had played with that toy always in the tub, like that Aquaman figure. You know, I was going woo 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 woo, you know, trying to control fish in the water and all kinds of stuff. And that was like my favorite toy, to the point that like his feet came off and the wire was exposed. But I loved Aquaman, and I love the Super Friends. You know, it's Wendy and Marvin. They were even interesting at when I was, you know, roughly five.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Wonder Dog I thought was amazing because I've always loved dogs. But it was a great cartoon, and that cartoon led me to get comics. I didn't come from like a wealthy family, so my dad introduced me to comics when I was very young, kind of around the time Super Friends came out in 73. And what he found out is that back then we didn't have a garbage place that would come and pick up your garbage, like, you know, every Friday or whatever. Mm-hmm. You have somebody come pick up your garbage. We'd actually take our garbage to the dump. And my dad found this spot that the drugstore would immediately – back then, I think the comics were refundable off the spinner rack. So the way they got some of their money back is they'd rip off at least the whole cover or half of the cover and ship it back to the publisher, and they'd get some credit back.
Right.
And then they would take boxes of these. They would put them in well-crafted boxes so they didn't have garbage all over them and just toss them. And my dad found out about this, and we would go to the dump. I mean, who would think about going to the dump? You know, be like one of your favorite times. We're going to go through some trash. But that was like my thing. I was like, yeah, we're going to go through trash. And back then people threw away batteries and all kinds of crap. You know, there wasn't like recycling too much. It was just garbage everywhere. But these boxes were pretty well contained, and my dad knew that they were going to do it every other week or something like that. And we would just go out there, find these boxes and bring them home. And there was a wealth of comics in there. A lot of them were these giants that had many, many stories and reprints in them. And I didn't know what the cover was. And I was too young to know what the number was, or to look at the bottom of the cover to know what number it was. And I didn't care. When you're a kid, do you really care? And I was barely learning to read. At five, I knew words, but I was mostly looking at the pictures. And basically, comics taught me how to read. And I remember in the sixth grade, I think it was the sixth grade, I got like an award because I was teaching other kids to read because I was bringing in comic books to the classroom, and people were more interested in that than reading these books that the teachers had. And I had a good elementary school teacher, because back then she would just let me bring the comic books and read during – we used to have like those half-hour reading sessions or something, and we could read comic books. And it just – it exploded. I mean and then when we actually had money, like later on, you know, later grades, we would trade. And I swear to you, if you saw some of the comics that went through my hands and I traded away, you would be like, "Wow, what did you do?"
Oh my God. Those are steps. If we could go back in time, I still remember with clarity ripping off the cover of Giant Size X-Men number one.
Or doing the damn stamps. Do you remember?
Oh,
the stamps?
Yeah, the Marvel stamps.
Cut those stamps out. Yeah.
Oh God, yeah, and the dioramas on the limited collector's editions, the giant size for the DC. I don't think I had a single one that had a back cover with that, and those things would just evaporate. Yeah. But so we are pegging 73 as the start there, and it's something I've always maintained, and something that you touched upon was, in terms of content, this was such a great time to get into comics, because Though DC and Marvel had very different reprint packages Marvel's tended to be more sequential, where DC was kind of a mishmash. There was plenty of them. So you came in, particularly at this time, with, you know, being exposed to different periods. I just went through the 100-page Super Spectaculars, just looking at the info on Mike's Amazing World. And you look at the Golden Age reprints that you were being exposed to at this time. Batman, Dr. Fate, Kid Eternity, Dollman, Guardian and the Newsboy Legion, Ibis the Invincible, Black Canary. I mean, it's just all these, you know, amazing old strips that really gave you a very broad sense of history that I don't think some other periods of comics, the people getting into comics benefited from. Yeah, I've always maintained that was a really good time to get in to develop a sense of the history.
Having not seen the covers at the time, I used to always be able to tell them because they were bigger. And then some of those older stories would have like a weird print on the bottom and the top of the page.
Right.
I can't remember. Yeah, and it would distinctively know it was like a giant size. But I like loved them. I loved discovering all the different heroes. Matter of fact, what my first comic I bought off the shelf was like a 20-cent edition, and it's a bizarre comic because it was like a 1973 issue of Ghosts, and I can't figure out. I remember my grandfather took me to this, to the, I think it was like a TGNY, which was like a, I don't know, it was like a store where you could buy various things, and my grandma told him, go buy him a little golden book. Do you remember those little golden books?
Oh, absolutely.
So he was targeting the little golden book, and I saw the spinner rack, and I convinced my grandfather to get me a comic book, and it was an issue of Ghosts, DC's Ghosts. And I remember when we went home with that issue, my grandmother just yelled at him for about a half hour. Because I didn't come home with a golden book. I came home with an issue of Ghosts.
Yeah. For me, I had had a couple of comic books prior to Super Friends and all that. There's one that survived, which is an old Walt Disney Comics Digest. It was a Christmas story, which when I looked up, it came out in the fall of 1972, which kind of makes sense with when I remember I started to learn to read. And the first superhero comic I have, and it's vivid, the recollection of buying this. Again, Super Friends premiered in the early part of September 73. And so it took me a couple weeks to get that there was superhero comics. But it was Action Comics number 430, which had a Superman lead, as always, and an Atom backup. And I read that comic book. I read it to pieces. You know, I just...
Yeah.
Was so fascinating, and from there was a very short jump, you know, very short puddle jump into other books that were on the stands. And by the time Christmas hit, my parents knew that this was something I was into deep, and that was a good Christmas. I can tell you that. I can tell you that. In terms of the books that came out, and now again, some of this may be in hindsight because, as you've mentioned, you started collecting books from 1973 on to try to get entire runs. I, without telling you this, I basically did the same thing. I started a little earlier just because I had such a fascination with the 25-cent era, where it was DC went to giant size, the 52 pages for about a year. So I kind of started from that point and worked forward, but I'm basically doing the same thing. And, you know, there's a couple of issues here and there where price-wise it may not make much sense, but most of them you can still find, you know, whether they be reader copies or at conventions for deals, you can find them.
You could find them in the double digits at least, some of those early ones.
Yeah,
especially if you're willing to go to the VG level, you know.
Yeah.
Which I often do. I often do that. I've I'm really close to having the full run of Flash. I already have Green Lantern, Superman, Action, Wonder Woman, almost have the Justice League, and then all the obscure stuff, even the 90s stuff. There's some stuff I'm missing, but it's usually like Joni Thunder or something like that, you know.
Right.
Most of the mainstream stuff I've always gotten, and the one that I've always gotten, like I've told you, you know, there's times financially when you're saving for something or whatever, or you don't have a job at the time. And I would always get Flash. I don't care if it's bad or good or whatever. I am so bound to the character because that's the character that, I don't know, I always, even in the playground, I remember running like all the time saying, I'm the Flash. It was either the Flash or Hawkman. I don't even know what Hawkman did except fly at the time.
Right.
But I would always run around saying, ah, like a hawk. And I don't even remember Hawkman doing that. I would always pretend I had my mace and was clubbing things.
Hopefully not other kids.
Not other kids, yeah. Yeah. And then later on, this might have been in the late 70s, but do you remember that live action show that was really corny, Legend of the Superheroes?
Oh,
or something,
yeah,
the two
episode special.
Yeah.
Ooh, yeah, that was...
It might have thought it was corny, but when I saw it, I thought it was amazing because if you remember the graphics on the Flashes, he would just be standing still and then you would see a blur.
And he would be in a different position.
Yeah, he'd be in a different position. Yeah. But when I saw that, I was like, oh my God, that is the coolest shit ever.
Yeah,
and I don't know. I've always been biased towards the Flash. So when I saw that, and I never thought I would see like a live action Flash. And we've gone through like two iterations. You know, we had that wonderful series with Wesley. I can't remember that guy, but he's in the new Flash.
Yeah, John Wesley Shipp.
Yeah, John Wesley Shipp. I love that show. Mm-hmm. And then now we have the cool Flash that's on the CW. And I love that character. And he was introduced to me first in the Super Friends.
Right. Now, one thing I thought that was great about Super Friends, which I think gets a slam very often, was something you mentioned, Wendy, Marvin, and Wonder Dog. And for me, looking back and having seen that first season fairly recently, that was really a great device for kids to have basically like an entree into hanging out with the superheroes. It was
right.
To me,
right.
There was nothing better than their life, you know?
You got it. It's something you can relate to. There's two normal people with a dog, you know, and later on it becomes the Wonder Twins, but those people had powers.
Yeah. But, you know, for us, these were two regular kids and, you know, they're just like us, except like, oh, on Sundays they have picnics with Kryptonians and Amazons.
Yeah.
For somebody, I think, our age, it was just perfect. It was just perfect in so many ways. And, you know, also with the shows, they're kind of ridiculous because nobody gets punched. There's no real violence because, you know, it was the era of action for children's television and everything was very much sanitized. But, you know, there's something charming about every episode dealing with an ecological issue or racism or something along those lines. You know, there's nothing wrong with being taught lessons in that format. And
I believe to this day, this is might sound stupid as hell, that I was taught ethics from comics.
Yeah.
I was taught what was good and bad. Yeah, my parents always would ring it home, but comics distinctively told me what good and bad was, you know?
Right.
And it was the Super Friends too. I always knew what evil was. I always knew what good was. And it had to do with these superheroes to this day that I can't get enough of. For the cartoons, it was always DC for me. And I think it was like 74, 75 before I had a few of those drugstore comics with Spider-Man in it, which were really good comics at the time in 73, 74. But when I first picked up my first Marvel comic, it was a Defenders issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being blown away because it had the serpent. Serpent Society, or it was one of those snake groups, and it was really racist.
Yeah.
It was like a race. They were a racist organization that went after the Defenders and defeated them. The Sons of the Serpent. That's what they were.
Sons of the Serpent. That's right.
Yeah. And it was a Steve Gerber book. And when I read that, I was like, man, who are all these characters? You know, I knew the Hulk And I was like, but who is this, Doctor Strange and Nighthawk? And I was just in, and to this day, I still think those are my favorite costumes. I like love them. I
Right.
love, I like have a special place in my heart for the Defenders, even though they're not like a functional group. They're so dysfunctional, it's not a bit funny that you even ask yourself, why are they even together? But they had like in this Sons of the Serpent, they even had like a Yellow Jacket. They had Daredevil. It introduced me to like a wealth of characters in this crossover. And then I got kind of hooked into the Marvel for a little bit, but for some reason the DC heroes were so different. I can't explain. I have no like I'm not like biased, like you have to read DC and be a DC fan. I'm a fan of all comics. I love comics. But DC for some reason, if I had to pick a company, that's my company. And it's because I am so vested in the characters. Not just even I want to read the bad stuff. Because to me it's all history. It's all history. I want to know the ups, I want to know the downs. And in truth, every time I read a back issue, I find all kinds of value in it. Like I'll that happened. I'll like take notes, and I was like, wow, that's really cool. And I am revisiting a lot in my Retrocast, and I love for that is my favorite podcast that I do that I prepare for because I get to go through like long boxes. Not only that, but I get to order stuff, and it is the funnest thing. It's like Christmas.
Well, one thing you said about getting into DC in terms of that's your principal area of interest, mine as well. And I think one thing that was always a criticism for DC, or it was treated as a criticism, was DC superheroes were the superheroes you would want, where Marvel were the realistic superheroes you would get. And that was always said in a sort of derogatory term for DC. But I've always felt there's nothing wrong with idealized characters. And when they throw reality into this, I love reminding people, hey, we don't have mutants and Skrulls. They don't exist. So kind of throw that out the window there. And another thing that struck me as I was doing some research for this is when we got into comics, the market had retracted considerably for some companies. There was some ridiculous thing, like they were like 20 Richie Rich titles. I mean, you couldn't. I mean, Richie Rich was doing A-OK at that point. But for DC, when we got into comics at the 20-cent era, for the year of 74, the superhero books had retracted to only 12. If you take a book like Adventure Comics, which featured the Spectre at the point when it was essentially a mystery book, a horror book at that point, it was only 12 comics. And that kind of surprised me because it just felt like it was bigger than 12 comics.
It did, but we were a lot
Yeah.
smaller.
Yeah.
All I remember is how big that spinner rack was and how little I could buy. I remember, man, how can I choose one? It there there's a, it, it seemed like there was 100 books on that spinner rack, and usually I would only have 20 cents or whatever to get one. And you don't know how hard it was. I would sit there sometimes for at least half an hour, if my parents let me, and look at the spinner rack and say, "Man, which one am I gonna pick?" And usually it was a DC comic.
And for us at this point, like going indie was like Charlton or Gold Key. That was something so different.
And my spinner rack, I don't remember too much of those. I remember Archie and Marvel and DC. I don't remember too much of the Charlton. I don't know if it's because the drugstore never carried them or what it was, but I discovered those way later with my infatuation of the Blue Beetle and Question, and I jumped in all in on those.
Where I grew up when I first got into comics, there were two candy stores which were in walking distance. And that was a really good and a bad thing because, if you found a dime on the ground and then had another dime, I can't believe like the thought today of like a 6-year-old going down two blocks without parents escorting. But at the time, it was like, you know, no one cared.
But, and when I got when I got about seven, I would walk to the drugstore myself.
Yeah.
And I was at least
it wasn't anything out of the ordinary.
Maybe a quarter of a mile away.
Ooh.
Yeah.
A lot farther than the two blocks. Okay.
Yeah, but I would go. My parents trusted that, you know, it was a lot safer back then. And usually I would go with three buddies and we would just walk there, go get our comics and come back. And the thing that was amazing is, yes, we could only buy like one comic, but that was three of us buying a comic. And that's where the trading came in. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'll read this and then you can get that. So we had like these decisions, right? It was like, oh, I want this one. Do you want to read this one later? And then, yeah. And we'd go back and forth, but we'd pick like three or four comics between us and then end up trading them until we read all of the stories. So, yeah, it was a good time.
Okay, what I thought might be a cool idea to do at this point was, again, as prep for this episode, I should ask you this. Are you as addicted to Mike's Amazing World website as I am?
I love the site. I didn't use it as much because I have a thing called Comic Base.
Right.
And I absolutely love Comic Base. Like, I think it's the best database for comics for large collections.
Yeah.
And I love the zoom in on the covers. I love the searches. I love the reports I can make. But Mike's Amazing World is amazing. A matter of fact, I don't know if it was you or somebody else that sent me the link, because, you know, I was talking about the dollar comics.
Right.
And what I found very interesting is I thought I knew all the dollar comics that I was targeting to complete my collection, because those dollar comics were much later, late 70s, early 80s. And absolutely loved them to pieces, because when you spend a buck on those, you got your money's worth. You got like 5-6 stories with different characters. Mm-hmm. And right. I loved the anthology at that time.
Yeah.
And sometimes those anthologies, it would just continue. You'd read one story, it'd continue into the next.
Yeah.
And it would merge with a different hero. And I didn't realize until that I saw that link that there was like Dollar Comics for House of Mystery. And there was a few others that I just was ambivalent to that I was like, man, I got to target these too.
Yeah.
Site. Matter of fact, he's a fun guy to follow on Facebook. I really like reading his posts.
Yeah. Yeah, one thing that really struck me with particularly World's Finest, when that became a dollar comic, when you were reading that with the book which had, you know, 5 features in it, I felt like this must be what like reading a Golden Age comic was like.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's the closest equivalent I had to it growing up, that it was just, you know, it was so big. And, you know, as you said, you know, sometimes they would have narratives that would go through, you know, the entire issue, you know, whether it be Superman family or something else, you know, that there would be a thread that linked all the stories in some way. And yeah, a lot of affection for that time period too. So anyway, when I mentioned about bringing up Mike's Amazing World, was I did my little spinner rack thing, and I went through the books that really had some impact on me in my first year of comics. So what I thought I would do is I'd go through this list with you, and maybe we can talk about some of the creators and if there are any touch points that you might share with me here.
I could tell you who my creator was of this period.
Okay, who was that?
Cary Bates. I loved that
man.
Oh,
okay.
Absolutely loved him in Superman and the Flash.
Uh-huh.
His imagination would blow me away. And in these stories, it was cool because you know how they would always they were formulaic. It would usually – you'd open the first page and you'd see like this situation. And you're like, how the hell did he get in this situation? And then you would read how they got there. And then they would conclude the story.
Yeah.
Such a great time.
Okay, well, I had mentioned earlier that my first superhero comic was Action Comics number 430. And fairly soon after getting that, I, for some reason, my grandmother gave me a dollar, which was like a, you know, that was like a fortune.
That's
back then.
A lot of money.
That was money. And I went right for the 200 page super spectaculars that were on the stands at that time, which were Detective Comics number 438 and Shazam number 8. Then, October 73, Justice League of America number 109, which was, we still had a few issues left with Len Wein's run. And I love the Len Wein Justice League from that time period.
Oh, yeah, that was
a great
time. I absolutely
love that. And in that particular issue, Hawkman left. And, you know, I learned later on.
Oh, this issue I love.
Yeah.
I remember it just by the cover.
Yep, with Superman with Superman throwing that door open. One of you said you're going to leave, and I want to know who or something like that. And within the story, it's actually a very textbook Justice League story. Eclipso is the villain, and at various points, segregated teams go and fight these Eclipsos that were separated through this magic. And again, there's the threat of Hawkman leaving, and this is going to be his departure from the team. Now, mind you, this is my first issue of Justice League. And even in the first issue, I know that this was, you know, seismic. This was something, you know, big.
Yeah.
And the issue ends with Green Arrow in tears, who couldn't even say goodbye to Carter. And this is another thing. I don't know if you do this, Mike, but I tend to talk about a lot of characters by their first name. It's like it seems like I have such a such a personal identification to them.
Yeah.
So it's like Ollie and Carter instead of their superhero names.
Right.
But throughout the recent history at the time of Justice League, there was a lot of tension between Green Arrow and Hawkman at the time because they, you know, they basically embodied the different ends of the political spectrum.
Yeah, Hawkman's more of a warrior and aggressive,
yep.
And
yeah.
Green Arrow's for the everyman.
Yep, it was
more of a passive.
It was conservative on one level, liberal on the other, and so the issue ends with Black Canary coming in and seeing Green Arrow in tears that Hawkman had left the group. And it was for some back then, that shit was like Ibsen to us, you know. I mean, that was like, you know, that was just, you know, a very adult thing to be reading, you know, right from the get-go. It's just something else. I really enjoyed that,
yeah.
And that really left an impact. Some other books that were from October 73, my first tabloid, limited collector's edition, number 24, which was Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
And that's interesting. I just bought a Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer comic book.
Yeah, one of the regular size comics. Or
yeah,
one of the
regular size one. And everybody that I ran across said, "Why are you buying that?"
Because it's cool.
Yeah, that's what my answer was.
And then Adventure Comics number 431, which brought about the Spectre, lead feature in the series for about a year and a half, and that had this fantastic art by Jim Aparo. As much as I love Aparo Batman, his Spectre, I think that's the best work he ever did.
I discovered the Spectre way later than you did. But when I read those stories, they blew me away. They were so vile, violent.
Yeah.
And dark. It was Michael Fleischner, wasn't it? Or
yep. Fleischer was the artist on that.
Yeah, and he was great.
Yeah, it was very, but you're right. It went to some really dark places.
Yeah, because he would always like kill the villain based on something that they did in the story.
Right.
Like if they were robbing a barber, he would cut their head off with a pair of scissors or something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. If he was a sea captain, he'd be swallowed by an octopus. Yeah.
You got it. Yes. Yeah.
Another book that came out in October 73, Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes, number 200, which was the wedding of Duo Damsel and Bouncing Boy. And that was my first Legion issue. And, you know, looking back, there were so many cool things about that issue, especially if you go to this was the first time I remember a double page spread where you had the wedding ceremony and the Martian Manhunter was one of the wedding guests. I had just seen the Martian Manhunter somewhere else. It just, he wasn't in Justice League at the time. I was just exposed to him, and I just thought that was cool, and that, you know, made me question about time periods. It's just weird stuff. Also from October 73, Mr. Miracle number 18, which was the last issue that Kirby did of any of the Fourth World until the Hunger Dogs.
Yeah.
And that was a weird ass comic for me. I didn't get Kirby for a long time.
Well, I'm glad I discovered him when I discovered him, because yeah. I didn't discover him or have a, I don't know if you see what most of the stuff I'm a big Kirby fan, like huge.
Right.
And it didn't happen until late in my career, you know, life, when I realized what he had done.
Mm-hmm.
And I really got into the 70s Kirby. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I just reread all the Fourth World stuff, so it's real fresh in my head. But,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know how I would have taken it back then. It was so different.
Yeah, it didn't look like anything else that DC was putting out. And at the time, it didn't look like anything that Marvel was putting out either, because he wasn't on staff there either. And it was just... I knew it was different. It just didn't have a charm for me, but that hit me later. Trust me, it hit me later.
Oh, it hit me big time.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going through time. JLA number 110, which was this really bizarre Christmas story where this guy dressed as Santa Claus got murdered, and Green Lantern is one of the members on call, but he slips on a bar of soap and hits his head. And while his power ring is protecting him from injury, it still has to heal so he doesn't have a concussion. So the ring by John Stewart gets activated. And it's a Christmas story. And then Batman number 255, which had a story Moon of the Wolf, which was the lead story, and that was my first exposure to Neil Adams as an artist.
Yeah.
And later on that year, as I said, my parents were always really good about fostering interest for me. You know, if I showed an interest in something, they would cultivate it. And that particular Christmas, I want to talk about the Migos later, but that particular Christmas, when we were growing up, there was no such thing as trade paperbacks, effectively.
Yeah.
And they bought me the Jules Feiffer hardcover, The Great Comic Book Heroes, and the two, the Superman and Batman from the 30s to the 70s books.
Wow.
And, you know, there I had more exposure to Neil Adams and, you know, just a great encapsulation of history. And that was all within that was the same day I got those three books.
Right. Well, let me ask you this, though. When you were in the 70s, were you even aware that who was doing what? I guess when I was in the 70s, never paid attention to the names.
It's interesting you can tell me that you brought this up. It was because of Justice League of America. That was the first time I really noticed creators, because Len Wein had left the book and then Denny O'Neil had written a couple of issues, and I could feel a change in the book. And the way it was written, it didn't seem to have the same team cohesion. It seemed it was a lot more bland in the depictions of the characters. It seemed that Len's stuff had a lot more sense of character development. And that was the first time I think I really noticed it. And then I saw in the credits, hey, you know, maybe these names make a difference. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was actually that. Okay, so continuing with my list, January 1974, oh boy, this was huge. Famous First Edition, or Limited Collector's Edition, whichever parlance you prefer, C26.
Those large covers,
yeah. Oh, yeah, but the reprint of Action Comics number 1. Oh boy.
Right, and, where did you get that from?
The newsstands at the candy store didn't have them, but... at the time, my dad worked as a probation officer, and one of the probates he checked in worked at Newark Airport, and Newark Airport had them on the newsstands.
Oh, nice!
So that's where at least the first ones I remember getting.
Because I never saw those big books ever. I would usually cut out the little coupon and send away for them.
Yeah. After a point, there were stores. I moved in August of 74, and then in the new town that I moved into, River Ridge, New Jersey, there were stores that had them on racks.
Yeah.
But initially, when I initially lived in Passaic, New Jersey, the locals, they just didn't have them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was really late to the big ones. My first one was Superman versus the Flash.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to send away. And I should send you a picture of it because I still have it. It's so beat up. me and my friends read that issue over and over and over again. And I fought tooth and nail that the Flash won.
Yeah.
And if you remember on the cover, it had like certain characters rooting for Superman on one side and others rooting for the Flash on the other side.
Yeah.
And it was, man, it was like a photo finish where
I guess I'm the fastest. Yeah, I remember that whole story.
It was that giant size. That was my first exposure to them racing. And man, I absolutely loved it. I beat the hell. I must have read that story like 25 times.
Yeah.
And argued. I mean, I would get really mad. I was like, this is the fastest man alive. There's no way this guy can win.
Yeah. That's cool. Keep going on my list here. Sandman number one, which was the Simon and Kirby reimagination of Sandman.
Yeah.
And that was my very first number one issue. That was the first time I had a number one comic. And I thought, wow, this is like going to be, this is, you know, this is seismic. And then there wasn't a second issue for like a year. It's weird. Superman Family number 164. This was kind of an important development. DC, as I had mentioned, had contracted their line, and almost all of their titles, superhero titles, became 100-page super spectaculars. Almost all of them were bi-monthly. The only monthly titles were Superman and Action. It's
you
just amazing.
164. Wow, and that's the first one.
Yeah, that's the first one. It previously had continued the numbering from Jimmy Olsen. And for years, there was enough of a market for Superman that Lois Lane could maintain her own title. Jimmy Olsen could maintain his own title. Supergirl could. And the decision was made to consolidate the three. And love those 100 pagers. JLA 111 and 112. This is a meeting of the Injustice League and Libra, who later resurfaced in Final Crisis. And it was a really zen story about Libra siphoning their energy, and it was too much, and he became one with the cosmos and shit. The thing that struck me about that is there was a thread that continued into the next issue where the Justice League had lost half their powers, and Aquaman had to have a bowl on his head with water, and the Flash wasn't as fast, and Batman was kind of like dim-witted.
Yeah.
And to restore their powers, they decide to reactivate Amazo. Not probably the best idea, yeah, they found out. But that was also, at least for DC Comics, that was the first time I remember a thread continuing from one issue to another. Because, you know, most of the times it was like one particular, you know, it was contained, it was done once. So I just remembered that. Wonder Woman 212, which is the start of her trials to see if she was, to see herself if she was worthy of rejoining the Justice League. And that was a cool period where, you know, there was be a Justice League guest starring, a Justice League member guest starring in every issue, and and that was early on in my Wonder Woman exposure. There weren't too many issues I had before that. June 74, OMAC, who I know has a very special place in your heart, was the first appearance, and I don't remember getting OMAC books as a kid. Maybe one. It was much.
I only had a OMAC without a cover. That's it. But I loved the I remember it distinctively. I remember him walking across the bottom of an ocean with skis.
Also that same month, June 74, Superman 279. Now, at the time, there was no DC Comics Presents. The only team-up title was Batman with Brave and the Bold. And this was a team-up of Superman and Batgirl. And you had mentioned the Superman and Flash tabloid that you had that was beat up to hell. You should see my copy of this. I just read it and reread it, and I thought, oh, God, they're going to be a team from now on. Because they kind of hinted almost that there was a possible romance between the two of them, at least in that second issue, you know, that there was some interest because there was as much time in the issue as Clark visiting Barbara as there was with the Superman-Batgirl team-up. That would have been cool if they did that. July 74, Detective Comics number 443, which was the end of the Manhunter series, which was written by Archie Goodwin with art by Walt Simonson. That series kind of spooked me as a kid. As you mentioned, like Kirby, there was nothing else that looked like it. There certainly was nothing like the way that Simonson was drawing at the time, and just took me years to get it. But
It's weird how some of the art that I didn't care for early, you know, really grew on me and some of my favorite now.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So it's like it's bizarre how that happens.
Yeah. The other person that certainly happened with me was Steve Ditko. My first exposure to Steve Ditko, I was like, it was just was so strange. And I'm sure my first exposure would have been the Charlton Horror reprints, because I did get a few of those, and it was just, you know, everybody looked so ugly, and I didn't get it at the time, but he's just not at the right age.
The early Spider-Man, when I was young, I didn't like it, mm-hmm. because I would compare that with whatever was on the shelf, and I was like, man, why does that look so weird? Because my early Spider-Man, like the 12-cent Spider-Man, mm-hmm. I was exposed to it because there used to be a bookstore place called B. Dalton, mm-hmm. and they used to have these like little pocket comic book things. And you would buy them, and it would have like, oh, here's all the Spider-Man stories. It had like 12 stories in it. Yeah. And I was like, wow, this art is weird.
Yeah.
And then when I was exposed the same way to the early Doctor Strange, which was Ditko too, I was like, what? Why does this look so weird?
Yeah.
It's funny that you mentioned it. We had a similar reaction at Ditko.
Well, one artist that I did have an instantaneous affinity for was Mike Grell. Was first exposed, I think, as most people were, as in an Aquaman backup, but then Phantom Stranger number 33, which had a team up with Deadman, and I read the shit out of that book. And then the last book I want to mention, going through my little tour here, was again, JLA was a really important book for me, and still one of my favorites in any form, and that's JLA number 114. Which was this really cool story about Snapper Carr, who had been on the outs, who was the former mascot of the Justice League, betrayed them through trickery by the Joker, and though he was welcome, he didn't feel welcome, so he was basically written out of Justice League for years and years and years. Makes an appearance in this story where he's watching a telethon that the Justice League members are hosting, and there's this Anachronus, I think is the guy's name, kidnaps Snapper Carr's family, and he's on the phone with the telethon speaking in code, and the Atom comes and does this really cool punch through the phone, and again, a very formulaic Justice League story where this villain is recounting this story of when he previously fought the Justice League. And since Snapper Carr used to be their archivist, he knew this was total bullshit. And it's a very hard story to describe, but if you read, it has a very quick and breezy linear sense. So I'm not doing the story justice, but that was a lot of fun. And I also have a very distinctive memory, something I touched on in August of 74, I moved, and I still remember the back seat of the sky blue Ford Fairmont, and I had a pile of comics, and this issue, JLA number 114, was on the stack, and it's just a very vivid memory of that particular book tied with that particular event. So those are the books that I spotlighted. Are there any books from 73, 74 that really stuck out with you from DC?
It was pretty much the Flash runs, especially the ones that had one thing that was good around this time frame was the backups. Mm-hmm. So like if you bought Flash, you would also get Green Lantern. Mm-hmm. And he always had that ridiculous starfish on his shoulder.
Oh, I love the I loved him.
I used to love that, reading that. It's like, why is this? He has a pet starfish, and they had, I guess a lot of the characters had pets.
Yeah.
That his was a starfish. Yeah, so yeah, I was always I really like that Action Comics. Outside of the Flash and Action Comics, it was the Justice League, and it was just mostly because it was a lot of characters. But for some reason, I had at the drugstore that I went to, it was very hard to get a Justice League comic. They would go fast, and because everybody wanted to get most of the heroes, so I was lucky to get a Justice League comic at the time. I usually could get Superman, The Flash, Justice League. If it was there, I would grab it for sure. Wonder Woman, I didn't become a fan of until much later, but like I'm a huge Wonder Woman fan right now. I like buy all her statues and stuff, and that was the first character that I went and tracked down like all of the issues back to this time period. Matter of fact, I even have some Sensation Comics and some old, really old Wonder Womans. But well, I own like Batman 4. I
Jesus.
own a, some I own some Golden Age stuff, but I'm still trying to get, instead of going back and buying some really old stuff, I'm trying to stay as focused as I possibly can on getting this complete, which I absolutely love the time period, and I'm working my way pretty fast, at least for this time period, closing in on completing it. And that's every iteration, you know, that's like all the different volumes and stuff. It's not just the old original volume.
Now, you had mentioned with Justice League was that it was hard to come by on your newsstand because that would be the book that went quickest. Where I was, it was Spider-Man.
Spider-Man was the quickest of
Spider-Man,
Bendis.
I later discovered if you didn't get Spider-Man on the day it was released, you didn't have a chance. And
Yeah.
it was just, it may have just been emblematic of the two particular stores, the two particular candy shops that were right in my area. And with Marvel, you know, it wasn't as quick a love affair as it was for DC. But I quickly became a fan of Spider-Man, of Captain America, Marvel Team Up in particular. I really used to love Marvel Team Up, and that, you know, that was a cool way of getting introduced to the characters through the guest spots, you know, because they it seemed Marvel had a bigger repository of characters, at least as a kid growing up. It just felt that way. The Avengers, and as you mentioned, the Defenders. I was a fan of the Defenders early on, and I'm with you, Mike, in terms of like those costumes are my costumes. Like Namor to me is the outfit with the blue with the chest down to the navel and the wings. You know, that's Namor to me. It's like.
Well, even the time that Doctor Strange, he was like my favorite. When they had Yellow Jacket, like Yellow Jacket to this day, for some reason, is one of my favorite costumes. And I absolutely love like Nightwing. I mean, not did I say that right? What is
Nighthawk.
Nighthawk. Yeah. It's like that. No, I'm going into DC. Nighthawk. I love Nighthawk. And then they had Valkyrie. I absolutely loved her costume too, even though she's more like a, you know, barbarian type Red Sonja look.
The only other Marvel title I can remember really getting into around this time was Marvel Triple Action, which had the Avengers reprints. And I was trying to reconcile why there's this group of Avengers in this title, and in this other title, it's a different group. And
Yeah, you're reading older stories.
then I got it was reprints. And from that point on, I started buying a lot of the Marvel reprints,
You know
with
where
more.
Marvel really hit me was when they were 60 cents.
Oh, that late? Really?
Yeah, it
Oh,
was
okay.
late. That's when I started to buy every issue of Cap, every issue of Daredevil, every issue of who was the other one? Fantastic Four. 'Cause isn't that when Byrne was doing
Burn.
it? I think it was, yeah. That yeah, it was pretty doggone late. Because you know what was weird too, as a kid, I was totally into the war comics. Like Sergeant Rock. Like I absolutely loved Unknown Soldier, Sergeant Rock, and GI Combat. I mean, those, I had a lot of those comics, and it you know what I think attracted me to those titles was me and my friends would play army men like a lot, you know, just those little plastic army men that they had, and then we had like G.I. Joe with the beard, and so like it attracted me to the war comics.
Yeah, I never really got that into the war comics. The first one I actually got into was much later, which was Men of War when they introduced Gravedigger.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think mainly because I was on the ground floor with that, you know, that I could see the origin and move on. But I never really got in heavily into the war comics. Then when you go back and, you know, just these, I mean, Sergeant Rock in the late 60s and early 70s was like this effectively anti-war book.
Yeah.
Masquerading as a war book. And, you know, just, the, you know, really Bob Kaniger and Joe Kubert at their best.
Yeah.
There's some really, really good stuff there. And Unknown Soldiers had great Dunn and ones. It was really was the...
It was always, it was the same plot device. It was so
yeah,
it was so hilarious. But even to this day, I still love reading them because they're done in one. He goes in, puts a face of like a Nazi. They find out about him, and then he wins or escapes. But it's crazy because they're sad stories.
Yeah,
there's death.
Yeah, like
you see people die, you see
puppies die, and
yeah,
oh,
you see all kinds of stuff. And I was like, wow, I was reading this as a kid, and I'm just like rereading it now, and I was like, man, this is sad.
I can't remember if it's an Unknown Soldier or if it was a loser's story, but there's one where it's like this elderly couple and they're separated for some reason and they're just about to get back together and embrace and they both get shot in the head.
Yeah, I read something very similar.
Oh my God.
Except it wasn't a couple. It was a guy trying to find his wife, and then the wife, they actually found each other and the wife got shot.
Yeah.
I was like, God dang. You know, I was like, I used to read these all the time. And those ones we used to trade a lot. Like you said, sometimes the toys are your entry. A lot of it had to do with those little plastic army men. We used to have like wars and we used to set up stuff and throw marbles at the characters and blow stuff up. And yeah, it was a crazy time. But I sure like to talk a little bit about the Migos.
Oh, please do. Yeah.
You're getting some of the retro ones right now, and I'm jealous. I like want them, but I just don't have the space because I have all my original toys, all of them.
Really?
I wish I had that. Because I remember, man, my parents used to do this thing called a Christmas club, and it was basically they would save money in the bank. And then Christmas would come, and then we'd get gifts. And when Santa came, I got some interesting stuff because what we used to do is our parents used to throw either like a Sears catalog, or once they discovered Heroes World, I was just blown away because this Heroes World catalog, you couldn't really see what the toy looked like except from a drawing. And the drawings were usually done by like Kubert and his school. They would do a lot of these drawings of the Miko figures. And there was one year, I mean, I got a few off the shelf. Like I remember getting a Shazam off the shelf, a Robin and a Batman. But there was one year, it was probably one of my favorite Christmases ever, that I circled a lot of the Migos and I got a lot of them. I had like Cap, the Falcon. I had Green Arrow, which was my favorite, because to this day the original Green Arrow costume, like in the satellite years, is one of my favorite costumes of all time.
Yeah.
I had that Green Arrow. I still do, except his belt is not intact anymore. But I had the Arrow car. I had the Spider car, you know, with the web that would drop. I had Spider-Man, the Hulk. My brother had the entire Fantastic Four. I only had the Torch. But yeah, I just absolutely love these I never got the Titans, which you just got the retro ones, which absolutely look great.
For me, again, it's tied to Super Friends. I think it was literally, again, Super Friends premiered on a Saturday. The Sunday, I was out shopping with my parents, and we had a store which was kind of like a Caldor's or a Target at the time, a store called Great Eastern. And they had buckets where they had the first four super Mego superheroes that were on sale: Superman, Batman, Robin, and Aquaman. And this was like the they didn't have the window boxes; they were like the closed boxes.
Yeah.
And my parents told me I could get two; I couldn't get all four. So I was an only child. I'll admit I was a little spoiled, but they weren't crazy spoiling me. And so I got Superman and Aquaman. Oh my God! I lived with those dolls. I lived with them for ages. And then when it hit Christmas, between my parents and other relatives, I ended up getting all the eight figures that were available at the time, the original eight, the four I mentioned, in Shazam, Tarzan, Captain America, and Spider-Man. And the only accessory was a carrying case that was out at the time.
Yeah.
And it was a very big Christmas between the books that I mentioned earlier and the superhero toys. And I seem to remember getting a Batman Corgi, but it's a little cloudy, the Corgi metal vehicles, but that memory's a little cloudy. But the Mego and the three books I mentioned, memories of just enjoying the hell out of those are crystal clear.
Well, and then, one thing I remember is always losing the stickers.
Oh yeah,
I lost the Superman symbol, I lost the Batman, and
I lost them all. Yeah. It's interesting with the Figure Toy Company reissues. Would you mention that the Shazam has a replacement sticker in the bottom? I mean, that would have been ideal. But yeah, through time, I ended up, at least with the 8-inch figures, I ended up getting everything over time. But
you still have them or no?
I still have Superman, Batman, Aquaman, Robin, Wonder Woman, Riddler, Penguin, and Mr. Mixelplick in fairly decent form.
Ah, nice.
I have naked Shazam, naked Supergirl, naked Joker, naked Wonder Girl, and naked Speedy.
A lot of naked ones. What happened to their clothes?
Well, the street I grew up in, I was very close with two other families that had kids, the Weavers and the Alexudises, and we used to play everything together. It didn't matter what size. So the 12-inch Lex Luthor, he turned out he was Barbie and Skipper's father. So we would just have these things. And I think there were costume swaps because I think for a long time, Shazam had Starsky. Remember Starsky and Hutch? He had Starsky's outfit on. I don't know why. But we would take the clothes off and put them on other figures, and at some point they just go off. So yeah, they're naked, you know. It's not like I had naked Mego parties, but...
I think in the same time period there used to be a figure called Action Jackson.
Oh yeah, that was...
and in that sense you could buy a lot of different clothes for the figures.
Yeah,
like they would actually have different clothes. So you would constantly undress them, change the clothes, put on a different outfit. You could put a snow outfit on an army outfit and all kinds of different stuff. So I thought that's what you were doing, is like switching out costumes.
In a sense, yeah.
Yeah.
Mind you, like the other Ariadne and Helen and Wendy and Amy, they had a lot of Barbies and that type of stuff. So. There was a lot of like interact, like Robin dated Skipper, and there was a lot of stuff.
a lot of sexual stuff going on there.
But in terms of the other Mego stuff, I still have my Green Arrow car. I still have the Hall of Justice. I don't think the table's there, but at least the main units I still have. Batmobile, I have two Batcopters. Don't know how that happened, and that may be it. And the shark, Aquaman versus the Great White Shark during the Jaws fate, you know, craze.
Yeah.
So I still have the shark. And in terms of the Marvel, Spider-Man, Hulk, Falcon, the Fantastic Four, but most of the Fantastic Four I picked up in the late 80s. And Oh, what else? I think that's it from Marvel, for the Marvel 8-inchers. I had this thing where you mentioned Action Jackson. My first job out of college, they used to send me to Toronto a lot for these business meetings and seminars. And there, if there was a this one store where it was like a time machine, and they had, you went down in the basement and they had Fantastic Four figures that were like French language and Action Jacksons. And I remember like one time I was just like loading up with these toys. it was just so cool. Like just having this time machine. And that was 1989. So this is years after those should have been, you know, off the market then. But
the other ones that I have real fond memories and I still own are the Big Jim's pack.
Oh yeah.
Pedo Fist, Big Jim, Warpath. I have all of them, and I have the pickup truck with the motorcycle and the laser vet, which laser I absolutely vet. Love. Yeah.
I didn't have the pickup truck, but I did have the laser vet, and I never got that comic book, the comic book that they had.
Yeah.
That's another thing I miss about the 70s was you had those tie-in comics, like the Evel Knievel and the Star Team.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah, I love that stuff. But yeah,
I never had an Evel Knievel, but I would play with my friends a lot because we have that little spinning thing where you'd hit the motorcycle and then let it go and release it.
I never had an Evel Knievel myself because it was like the same thing. I had a very good friend who had one, so I played with him. Just like I never had the Mego Star Treks.
I only had one, and I still have it. Scotty, that's it.
But I never had an Evel Knievel, but I had a Robbie Knievel. It was like,
that's unusual. I didn't even like, know there was a Robbie Knievel.
Yeah, they had his son. They had like a little series with his son. I don't know why there was an appeal for Robbie Knievel for me, but
and I had a $6 million man.
Mm-hmm.
That one I still have, but I never had like an Oscar Goldman or any of the other characters.
Me either.
My brother for Christmas bought me the retro $6 million man and Sasquatch. So
are they 8-inch?
Yeah, they're the smaller Mego. Yeah,
oh,
they're not as big as the original one. He was pretty big. Uh-huh. He was almost like 12 inches or 13 inches.
Yeah, with that eye that was.
You could see through it.
It was a well-designed doll, and I had the what the hell with the Venus space probe. I think I still have that somewhere, I think. There's some, though, I never got into. Planet of the Apes was something I never got into.
Yeah, I didn't either.
Not the
movies. I would watch it, but I never got the toys.
I never.
And those were the Magos, too, so.
Yeah. I never got into that for some reason. Jeff Douglas, who people may know as Bean from some of the forums, he's a Planet of the Apes, you know, he's... you know, loves everything about it. And he's still astonished by that, where it's like, it was totally in your time. How did you not get into it? I never did. I don't know why. It never had an appeal for me. I was just thinking of also Marvel. You mentioned with Super Friends, the only other exposure we had to superheroes at the time, though, was, do you remember on The Electric Company when Spider-Man went out those?
Yeah. With Easy the thought Reader balloons. And
yeah,
the thought balloons.
Yeah, those are some things. I'd love to like just get a compilation and see all those in one shot someday.
Yeah, I did watch, I don't know if this was late 70s, but the Hammond TV series with Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, that's how I broke my arm. I was playing Spider-Man on a wall, and I fell through the wall and landed on my arm.
Yeah.
But that was the same time that the Lou Ferrigno Hulk was on, and then they released the Doctor Strange and the what was the other one? Captain America. On a motorcycle. I just recently bought that again.
Yeah, me too. And I loved those as a kid, the Captain Americas.
Mm-hmm.
I loved like the really cheesy like see through shield and the that was on top of his motorcycle. I thought that was
that shield would travel so damn slow, but it would come back and hit the villain.
Yeah. And it's interesting watching like those now, because like full of that like 70s sort of like I've got to find myself sort of vibe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then there was Man from Atlantis. That was another show I used to always watch. Matter of fact, I'd go to the pool and try to swim like that.
You weren't alone in that, I'll tell you.
It wasn't a very effective swim, I'll tell you that.
I have to say, I'm jealous of some younger people that had so much more, you know, because, like, you know, anything that was like that, like the Wonder Woman TV movie, God, that was like the hugest event. You watch it, it was nothing like Wonder Woman, but it, you know, it was something, you know.
Mm-hmm. And it's like now they have it coming out of the woodwork.
Yeah,
and we're getting older and we can't live forever.
Yeah.
It's like, but all those years you could have given me more. And plus, we didn't have VCRs. I don't know about you, but I would get up and watch the damn lines on the TV until cartoons started. I'd have my internal alarm. I'd go watch the color bars until they started on Saturday morning.
Yeah.
And I'd watch cartoons all day and then crash out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a real shame because I guess last year was the first time that there was no network children's television component on one of the major networks on Saturday morning. I mean, that's such a shame because that was, I mean, Saturday mornings were an event.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And forget, like, the premiere, you know, when you would hit September and the new shows, forget about it.
Oh, forget about it. The fall preview TV guide? Oh, my God.
Jeez. I mean,
I would plan. I'd get that TV guide and I would plan for everything I was going to watch. Have to jump from this station to this station. And then I would have the conflict like, oh my God, Super Friends is on at the same time as this. What do I do?
Yeah, and I remember that. I don't remember what show it was, but I remember, I think it was Valley of the Dinosaurs was on the same time as something else I wanted to watch. Yeah. And, like, at the commercials, I'd flip it quick and hope to get some of the episode before the – yeah, it was so much harder then, but it meant more, you know.
And it really did. The Marvel cartoons hit me way later, but they didn't come till way later.
Yeah.
Certainly. It was like Challenge of the Super Friends, and then I remember the New Adventures of Batman, that cartoon, and then Plastic Man.
Yep. When the Tarzan and the Super Seven, when they had that whole block.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just a lot. The Spider-Woman costume.
Spider-Woman.
Mm-hmm. And I think my first example of insomnia was the night before the premiere of Shazam. I literally was so excited I couldn't sleep. For live action, they would say live in person in the ads or something like that. And I was just so excited for Shazam. Oh, my God.
I can't believe that character hasn't exploded, because as a kid, he was an amazing character because he was a kid that would say this magic word and turn to a man.
Yeah.
You know, it was like something that everybody could relate to. I can't imagine being like in the 40s when that he came out and, you know, started out selling Superman. And then just for him to decrease so much because of that lawsuit.
Yeah.
And then when they acquired him, it never seemed to like take as well. And I love that character.
Yeah.
Absolutely love Shazam. It could have to do with the Shazam Isis Hour. Because I used to watch that all the time.
Yeah. Oh, all the Filmation shows. Space Academy. Oh, man, I went crazy for all of them. And it was in the 70s. I mean, Shazam was there was licensing left and right for Shazam.
Yeah.
Which, you know, maybe for somebody getting into comics at a later point might seem inconceivable. But if there was a Superman, Batman, and Robin product out there, there definitely would be a Shazam product out there, too.
Yeah.
He was everywhere.
And they had the Migos and the.
I still have a Shazam beach towel.
Oh, wow.
I guess it was probably around 75 or so. You had mentioned the Heroes World catalog and all that.
Yeah.
Well, a very big event for me was taking the trip over to the first superhero shop in Randolph, New Jersey. Oh, my God.
I can't imagine
an entire store filled of superhero stuff. It was, it blew my mind. It was literally, I was literally like, I think my parents told me like I could spend like something like $5, which was like, you know, a decent amount of money at that time.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't decide what, you know, I like, oh my God, there's like, there's these like, remember when you like used to put book covers? You used to put your books from school in book covers, and
Yeah.
I couldn't decide whether I wanted Superman or Aquaman for the book cover, and I was just, oh God, it was overload. It was too much. But
Yeah.
you know, it
Well, that's
was.
like my first Toys R Us. I remember we'd go to California because we never had a Toys R Us where I was. You know, I was in New Mexico. We used to go on these family vacations like Wally World. We get in the truckster and we just drive across country. And one of the stops all the time was, you know, Toys R Us. And man, I was just blown away because I never could understand. I couldn't comprehend. Yeah, there were those small toy stories or stores in the mall, but it wasn't like a Toys R Us. Like you'd see everything, like everything. And it just blew me away. I never got to see a Heroes World outside of the magazine.
Yeah, they were impressive, I have to say, as a kid, you know, just to have that much product in one place.
And they
Also,
had everything. I mean, the Heroes World was the size of a comic book. It
yeah.
was like 22 to 30 pages of material you could buy, and like the Mego figures would just take up two of them. So like you said, there was like towels, there was shirts, there was everything you could possibly want,
Yep.
superhero wise.
Gold coins.
Yeah.
They had these gold coins, and I can't remember, like, my parents, they were like, no, you're not, that's stupid, don't get that. But I have to say, Mike, that, you know, sometimes when you get guys in their 40s and it becomes war stories, and maybe we were guilty of this a little bit, but one thing I really appreciate about you on your podcast is you have such a positive view about comics, and you enjoy the medium so much, and it's infectious. And I just wish there were more readers like you, you know, that are of age, because I'm sure you've heard all these like grumpy old man podcasts, you
Yeah,
know,
yeah.
oh, I wish it was, I hate Grant Morrison, I hate what he's doing, hate New 52, blah 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 blah. And it's tough to take those after a point. It gets especially frustrating where I'm listening to a grumpy old man podcast and I'm actually older than the grumpier old men that are talking about it.
Yeah,
But when I listen to your stuff, you have such a enthusiasm for the medium that it really is infectious, and I always enjoy listening to you and talking to you about this stuff.
I love this shit. I mean, this is you don't know how much of a relief comics are to me. Maybe that's why I love them so much. I escape. Do you escape when you read them?
Yeah, there's nothing.
I am gone. I am not looking at the wall, or I don't even know where I am some of the times. I am totally absorbed in the comic book.
Yeah, I get that way too. It's I don't have a sense of time when I'm reading. You
I
know.
cry.
Yeah.
All it takes is one scene, like you said, of like Green Arrow or something, or just something that kicks an emotional trigger as a kid, and I'm in tears. And Barb will like, "Why are you crying?" And I'm like shedding a tear. I like sometimes I'm bawling.
And the last Bears podcast, I don't have to say this to you as a member of DC Noise. We get on tangents occasionally.
Yeah.
And we did a best of 2014 for our last episode. And we got on the topic of comics that made us cry. And by the time at the end we were talking about that, we're like, God, you know, like I almost started bawling again just recounting this, you know, what made me cry in the issue.
Oh
And
yeah,
these
I'll
do have
do
an
that just
effect.
talking about it. Not only that, but I get a sense of excitement, and what that causes is goosebumps. I mean, it could be like a trailer I see. Like when I saw Hulk just say Hulk smash, like just on the screen, they sold me there. It just like sold me. I was like already absorbed into the world. So like I don't get like I understand the mediums are different and stuff, but if I can escape into a world, I'm like totally happy. And then even like a bad comic, I learn something from it. And to me, it's like history. Like this is part of the continuity of the history. Even the New 52 to me, it's all continuous. In my mind, it never stopped.
Yep.
It just, things got morphed. Yep. Just like they've always done. In the 70s, it happened all the time.
Yep. There were always little tweaks.
Yes.
That always went on. You know, yes. If people think that there was a solid continuity set in stone, this has always been fluid. You know, it's just sometimes you hit something where there's a little more of a, you know, of a watershed mark where, okay, this is seismically different, but nothing's ever been set in stone. And one of my favorite quotes ever from a comic book, it's an imaginary story, aren't they all? You know, the stuff you love is still going on. You're just not seeing it right now.
Mm-hmm.
With a landscape that we have right now with so many independent titles and so many publishing houses and so many different platforms where you can get comic related entertainment, there's something for everybody.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
There's no reason at all in this point in time to complain because there's something out there for everyone. And
why waste your time hating when you can? Life is too short.
Yeah, there are some people that do that. You know, that they complain about a comic that they clearly have read two or three times again. You know, and like that's kind of the definition of insanity: repeating an action with, you know, expecting a different reaction after a time. And
to me, that's a good comic sometimes because it invokes an emotion.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you think.
Yeah, but
if it invokes an emotion and something, then I think it's well, you know, instead of, but I don't know. I don't know how to explain how I read comics. I posted earlier. I wish people could see comics with my eyes. I really do. I really, because, man, I am totally absorbed. And I know you are, too. I know you. I see you at cons physically. Yeah. I see that excitement. There's that little star in your eye.
Oh yeah, when you see that somebody picked up a book that you love,
yeah,
it's like a secret language among us. You know, there's these codes and secret handshakes in a sense, and you know, I know what you feel about that goosebump. I mean, I experienced it recently. I hope you did too, on The Flash when the doctor was recounting the list of people that were presumed lost in the explosion.
Oh yeah,
and there were some very familiar DC Comics names.
That was freaking awesome.
I literally got out of my chair, like doing, you know, like that, like sort of like Hercules, you know, that kind of thing.
I was on the elliptical. I remember distinctively, and Barb was like, "You know these names?" And I said, "Yeah, you're damn right, I know who these names are." And I was just like so excited. Yeah, I was like, I don't know. It's a wonderful medium, and it's a good hobby, and I love it, and I love the paper of it. I'm still having a hard time going over to the digital, but I use it occasionally.
Yeah, no, I hear you on that. I've been a little easier with the Marvel with digital than DC. DC, I think I'm going to have to get the physical no matter what.
Yeah.
But Marvel, I'm A-OK with someone handing me a code and saying that I got the comic, you know, but... and you know, space is always an issue. God, I really wish I had like access to a pocket universe so I could just put everything.
That would be awesome. And then you just stick your arm in when you want to get it, you know?
Yeah. That's the reason to market PIM particles.
Yeah.
Storage.
Oh, I would love to carry my whole collection in my pocket.
Here, this I'm talking about here. Yeah. And we're getting closer though. You know, we're getting closer.
Yeah. Maybe we'll see it lifetimes.
All right. Well, Mike, I think we probably should start wrapping this one up. But
sure.
Since there may be some listeners to this podcast that aren't as familiar with your shows that you're involved with, why don't you tell us about the shows that you're involved with and just basically a Reader's Digest elevator pitch about your podcast?
Geek Brunch is a show of there's two podcasts on there. One's Geek Brunch with me and Bill Bomer and Micah. And we cover comics, which is just anything. It's any time period, any company, pretty much everything. And then we cover TV, and we cover movies, and we cover food. There's where the brunch comes in. So we cover all of the different geekisms of all of it, except for the food. That just kind of goes out of control sometimes. But then we have the Retrocast, me and Chris Ivey. That one is my favorite to prepare for. Because we have a rule that we can cover anything that's 10 years or older. And we've been having a lot of fun reviewing like Buck Rogers lately, the TV show. And we went through like the whole Kirby, and then we have like random books that we read, and then DC Noise, which I do with Daryl Taylor and why am I blanking out on Keith Knutson? I had a brain fart there, and that show has morphed into something. I started it a long time ago with Eric Martin, and unfortunately Eric Martin passed away. He died of a heart attack very, very young. Matter of fact, we recorded the week before he died, and then he passed away, and it was really hard. And it took a while to get back into it, and I got Keith Knutson, and then the format of the show kind of stayed the same. And then what it's turned into is a bunch of old guys talking about life. It's very bizarre. So it's a very bizarre show. It's sometimes DC centric and sometimes it's not. So it's what you get. And then there's some shorts on there that's really DC focused. Like I do Batman Eternal and New 52 Future's End and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
With Chris Kazicki. And the last one is Valiant Podcast. That's with Chris Campbell and Daryl Taylor. And we formed that for our love of Valiant Comics. And we review a lot of comics in there. And that one morphs into tangent discussions, just like you get into.
Mm-hmm.
You sometimes start with a plan, and it morphs into its own monster, whatever that may be. But the thing that I love about podcasting is you do it because you love to talk. Like, we're talking now as fans of the comic book. We just so happen to be recording it, but this is like a natural conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't plan any of this other than we knew it was in the 70s.
Right. We were using 73 as a jumping point, and that was about it. Yeah.
Yeah. We were talking Super Friends, Amigo, and comics, and that's all we did. And this was all natural. None of it was scripted. So yeah, those are the podcasts that I do. Huh. And you can reach me on Twitter at Mike Myers Brunch if you ever want to talk.
Yep. Are you still on Mactivate on there?
I am. I like you had mentioned earlier, I have a fascination with OMAC, and I absolutely love the character, and every time he appears I get, you know, goosebumps.
Yeah.
Well, and it has to do with finding that comic with the skis when he's walking on the bottom of an ocean that has no water.
Just going back to Valiant Podcast, I do have to say, though, that you definitely influenced a buying decision of mine. Valiant is a big question mark for me, because when the original Valiant Universe hit, that was a time that I was not into comics, mainly because of financial reasons. You know, mm-hmm. you're out of college and you're kind of addicted to food and shelter, and, you know, some things have to go by the wayside. So I don't have much exposure to the original Valiant Universe. But then upon your recommendation, I took a dive into Archer and Armstrong and absolutely loved it. I mean, it's just
I love that book. I just love it.
And I really enjoy it because if you want to enjoy it for the ties to the other connectivity of the universe, fine. But that book really reads like its own universe as well. I don't know if I would have. I think I would have sampled it just because Armstrong's a bear, and, you know,
Armstrong reminds me of Keith Knutson.
Yeah,
like I not just because he drinks a lot, but there's just something about Keith and his human condition thing that and the way he's lived his life, that if he was immortal, and I would think he was Keith Knutson. Like, me and Daryl say it all the time.
Yeah.
He's Keith.
I really have enjoyed talking with you, Mike, and I hope we do this again.
I hope so.
First of many.
We talked before one time when we did the villains.
Yeah, I felt so bad about bailing because I was enjoying myself, but I literally was fighting. Because by the time I bailed off, it was like 2 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Well, we had like 6 people.
Well, yeah.
And we tried to march on to every one of them, and I think we got like 3/4 of the way.
Yeah. And I have to say, that was one of my most enjoyable podcast experiences, because the opinions on the books were so different.
Oh, yeah.
And
it was It was
and
great.
The, then when we were all in agreement, that was like, okay, this is a gem.
plus we had Bob Rietal, who has the Guinness Book of World Records collection.
I was wondering, with you, since you have comic base, how many comics do you have?
A little over 55,000.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have to get the exact count. I'm probably around 34. I think I'm around 34,000. Yeah.
I am growing in leaps and bounds, though, because of the 1973 purchases and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Now, does your collecting with that, does that extend outside superheroes? And are you getting things like the mystery anthologies and?
Oh yeah, that? I'm trying to get everything outside of Vertigo and you know, the other titles
like Wildstorm and CMX and all that.
Yeah, yeah. Although I have a lot of them.
Yeah.
But my focus is on DC proper. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah, I kind of been doing the same thing, maybe not as aggressively, basically sticking to the superhero stuff. But, you know, even with that, kind of on a quest to get all of the horror titles shifted to ongoing characters in the 80s. I want to get all the Creature Commando issues of Weird War Tales, and I want to get all the Eye Vampire. So I'm kind of on that track, too. My big holes, I have to say, are the Cassandra Cain Batgirl, Azrael, the two Catwoman series, Hitman, and Lobo. Those in terms of the long running series, those I have very few. But
I have all of those pretty much, except for the Lobo. I'm missing a lot of Lobo.
Yeah.
Because I don't know how I felt about the character at the time. Because it got to the point where it was kind of ridiculous.
Yeah. It was a book that wasn't as funny as I thought it was. Yeah. I felt.
But because of that, I want to reread it. Yeah. I want to read it because Ambush Buck is ridiculous, and I have a good time with that. So, yeah.
I have to say the biggest
missing House of Mysteries and the House of Secrets and Ghosts are probably my biggest holes.
Yeah.
And then I am missing a lot of war books, but I have a lot of them. In other words, I just have a lot of holes in there.
Yeah. And the other thing, I can't believe I started because they're not the easiest thing to come by. I'm trying to get all the digests from DC.
Oh, yeah. I got a few of those. Oof. Because a few of them are actually numbered as part of it, like Adventure Comics.
Yeah,
those digests are part of the physical number.
Yep, no, there was.
So if you want to complete your Adventure Comics, you better as hell get those digests.
Yeah, and something that I don't think people realize is there's some material that only appeared in the digests. There's these Challengers of the Unknown stories that are drawn by Alex Toth that are an adventure, and a lot of the Secret Origins issues would have new origins. Yeah, there's some wild stuff in there.
Yeah, I didn't notice that until I looked at my database and then said I need to complete it. Adventure Comics, I think I'm pretty much complete. I'm missing a few Aquaman, Plastic Man editions. Oh, okay. Other than that, I have all of it.
Yeah, I got all those. And when you mentioned Ambush Bug, I have to, since we were talking about comics that were funny, one issue of Ambush Bug, Year None, that gave me the biggest laugh I ever had as a comic book reader when he called up Gene Loring.
Oh yeah.
Sue Dibney's having a party, you're not invited. I mean, that's, you know, that's
talk about a book that made me cry.
Oh yeah, Identity Crisis.
Several times, like in huge tears, and matter of fact, rereads caused me to cry.
Yeah.
It's that book.
Comics that really made me cry: Animal Man number 15, which is the Dolphin Slaughter issue.
I mean,
and just that beautiful part where the human who had hunted the dolphins is drowning, and that dolphin brings him up to the surface, won't let him die because she says our way is different.
Yeah.
Oh.
Tearjerker.
Yeah. Daredevil Born Again, when, spoiler, when Matt asks Maggie if she's his mother, and she says no, and he can tell she's lying by her heartbeat.
Yeah.
And then there's Johnny Quest. There was this great series of Johnny Quest in the 80s from Kimiko. And there's this one issue which deals with this dog napping ring, this like Michael Vick type of dog fighting ring.
Yeah.
And Bandit's one of the animals that's been dognapped, and they're basically used as bait dogs to train and kill the pit bulls, the pit bulls will go after in their training. And there's this heartbreaking sequence where the narrative of the story switches to another dog who's dying of his injuries, and he's remembering what his life was like when he was a pet.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I'm literally like almost tearing up talking about it.
Well, you know what? I don't know if I could even stomach that. Like for some reason, I've always had pet bulls, pits.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate the way they're other people abuse them and how they're looked upon in society. And man, any of that stuff makes me cry.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, and that's
harder for me to see something happen to an animal.
Oh,
than it is to happen to a person in a comic book.
I'm totally with you there too. And I just think about recent comics that made me cry, whether it was the last issue of Why the Last Man with what happened to Ampersand, or the We Three, or Laika.
I never read
Oh, really?
It.
Well, make sure you have tissues next to you. But then sometimes it's not just animals. I mean, another moment that just tugged at my heart so strongly was in Jeff Johns' run of JSA, where Courtney and Billy were dating, and Captain Marvel, through Jay Garrick's intervention, broke it off. And I think everybody's had a moment in their time where a relationship has come to an end, not because of the two people involved, but because of outside sources of the two people involved. And man, he captured that just perfectly, that her anguish of Billy tell them, oh God. Yeah. They can.
Well, it's such an, it's like a romance that can't happen because nobody can understand it.
Yeah.
Like it's a social thing.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, Billy's a kid, but he turns into a man.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a weird situation.
Yeah. But I just thought, of like that sort of rite of passage of anyone being a teenager, of something coming to an end through no want of your own. Oh, man, he just captured that perfectly. Yeah, this stuff affects you.
It really does.
I'm with you there. I think my sense of morality comes a lot from these very simple lessons we were taught from four color characters.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot to that. But I think we're better people for comics.
I think so.
And what a great line to end on. Okay, so again, Mike, thank you so much for coming on the show. Again, this is a very special satellite episode of the Comic Book Bears podcast. You can find us as the Comic Book Bears podcast on the Facebook. You can find us as Comic Book Bears on Twitter and on, what the hell is it, a Tumblr? We have a Tumblr page. I haven't updated in ages. And we are proudly part of the Earth 2 Podcast Network. Please check out the other shows on the Earth 2 Network, which include Earth 2, Boob Tube, Wombates, New Worlds, and Great Expectations, the X-Men podcast. And you can find us on the iTunes and subscribe to us, and Stitcher Radio, we're on that right now too. And keep listening for more special episodes. We have a great one coming up. Get yourself ready for Bat Bear 66. With that one, I'm going to be taking a bit of a backseat, and I'm just going to let my three guests talk most of the time, because they're far better at the camp and the dish than I am, so...
Yeah,
I'm really looking forward to that. We initially thought, well, we'll do like one episode when the box set is released.
Yeah.
You can't do that series in one episode.
No. It's almost like a podcast in itself.
Yeah. And I'm sure someone is out there doing that. I'm sure they are somewhere. But yeah, that's another thing with like comic book podcasts. There's so many of them. I mean,
it is true, but I encourage it because it is. No matter how many there are, it's still a unique voice.
Mm-hmm. What? Just before we go, what are some of your favorites that you're not involved with?
My favorite, absolute favorite, is a fairly new one, and it's called Comics and History. Mm-hmm. It's done by Brian Reigate. He's a Canadian teacher, and the thing I love about him is I can sense his passion. It's very similar to my own, and I love the optimism, the way he approaches it, and I love the history. He does a lot of research behind it. That is my absolute favorite right now. The other two, I listen to out of habit, and I keep listening to them, and I enjoy them because one of them doesn't have any spoilers, and it just kind of like a preview of three comics every week. It was the one that Bob was part of, and he left a comic page. John Mayo.
Yeah.
And then the other one is Comics for Fun and Profit.
Okay.
Those ones are the ones that I always listen to. And I started listening to the Valiant, can't even think of this Valiant Central podcast, mm-hmm. which are kind of friends I've met through the one thing I will tell you about Valiant, it's a very unique company because the loyalty that it has, and it's like, I would say there's like 5,000 to 10,000 loyal readers. They're very loyal.
Mm-hmm.
It's very unique. A matter of fact, when I jumped on in the 90s to Valiant, it felt like it was like the first company I jumped in at ground floor.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like I was part of it. I can imagine it being very similar to somebody who was exposed to Marvel when they first exploded.
Yeah.
You know, you see all the continuity. The continuity could hurt them, though.
Mm-hmm.
Because it seems like comic book readers today don't want to get engrossed in the continuity.
Yeah.
And it's very, there's a lot of continuity. If you love continuity, I swear to you, Valiant's the place to go.
Okay. I do have the early Valiant trades. I think I'm missing one of the Unity sagas.
Yeah.
But I think I have all, and I got them for a song. They were like 50 cents each at a.
Have you read them yet?
I've read the first Solar. That was it.
Okay.
I really haven't taken.
There's some interesting things in there, yeah. Like ahead of its time kind of concepts. Like, man, there's just some weird stuff. Like the one Erica having like a sexual relationship with her son. It's just weird.
Okay.
There's just some weird shit there. but yeah, it's. I love all the shooter spinoffs, the Defiant, the Broadway.
Yeah,
that's great. I'm really into Dead Universes right now. That's the other hobby I'm doing is trying to collect Dead Universes. I finished the Ultraverse. I finished Valiant. I'm almost done with Milestone. Missing like three books. We talked about the Ultraverse.
Yeah,
you're the one that turned me on to the magazine.
Yeah,
I had no freaking clue that Conan magazine was. Thank you for that.
No problem. I finally found that after you. I think
you pointed out like I think three titles to me that I didn't know existed,
mm-hmm.
and then I went and I just got them because they weren't hard to get.
Yeah, that's the thing about some of this stuff. Some of it's hard to find, but if you find it, it's pennies.
Yeah. The Valiant ones are really tough. If you try to go for those last issues of the Acclaim, uh-huh. you're talking three digits.
Yeah,
because they're rare.
Yeah, the one thing I would be interested in, though it wasn't completed, I have the first issue of Unity 2000. Are the other issues really tough to find?
Two is more accessible. Three is tough.
Yeah,
I think three you'll spend at least $60.
Wow.
Yeah.
Jesus.
It's because they went under and they released these books. And I guess the distributor allowed them to cancel them because mm-hmm. they were late, right before the Acclaim went bankrupt. And there's like four books that are really rare. One's a Shadow Man, one's Unity 3000 or 2000, whatever it was. And then there's an Armorines, and I can't remember what the fourth one was, but they're really rare.
Yeah, that's interesting. Some of the later Milestones are kind of pricey too.
Yeah, it's like I had a hard time with Hardware number 50.
Yeah,
I finally got that one. I'm missing Zombie, X-Zombie, or however you want to pronounce it. The last issue, like you said, it's the last issue.
Yeah,
it's either the penultimate or the last issue.
Yeah,
they're kind of hard to find. The first ones are not hard to find. Static is going up in price because of all the rumors, but all the other stuff is pretty cheap. So I'm only missing like under 10 books a milestone. And then I'm kind of working on the Atlas universe.
All right. I am missing one Atlas book.
Oh, nice.
I'm missing Vicky number 3. And if you read those Vicky stories, imagine the worst Archie stories you can imagine and then like multiply it. They are horrible. And like the Vicky stories were redrawn from a Tower series. Tower was the company that published the Thunder Agents. So I have a lot of familiarity with Tower right now.
Oh, I am so glad you mentioned that. I forgot to order the fourth volume or fifth volume of the Thunder Agents. Thank you.
Okay, there you go. But you literally can see the whiteout where they changed the name from Tippy Teen to Vicky. You can literally see it in some of the issues. So bad. But I'm missing one standard comic and then two of their magazines. They're still manageable. There hasn't been a run on Atlas, and you know most of the books are crap, but they're fun crap.
Oh yeah, you know,
they're a lot of fun.
I love fun. A matter of fact, I have a huge kick on romance comics. I like learn so much about the time period and how weird it is. It just amazes me.
Yeah.
Especially DC romance.
Are you familiar with the blog Sequential Romance?
No.
Okay, you should check this out. This is a blog that's by Carrie Nodell, who's the granddaughter of Martin Nodell, who created Green Lantern. In the 40s.
Oh, nice.
And she has this blog where she goes through romance comics of the 60s and 70s. And it can be really funny, but it can also be really spot on about examining, you know, things that were going on at the time and how, you know, this might seem antiquated, but, you know, this was like cutting edge at the time. And it's a really good blog. And I think you'd enjoy that a lot.
Yeah, I had to check it out because I like them. This has been an awesome time. Let's do it again.
Yeah.
Even if it's like a few months from now.
Yeah, no problem.
We should talk about some other period or something.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Whoa!
In the Great Hall of the Justice League, there are assembled the world's four greatest heroes. Created from the cosmic legends of the universe, Superman, Wonder Woman, Batman, Aquaman, and those three junior super friends, Wendy, Marvin, and Wonder Dog. Their mission, to fight injustice, to right that which is wrong, and to serve all mankind.